Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to 19 Washington Square North, which is the intellectual home in the center of NYU Abu Dhabi here in New York. My name is Michael Pruganen. I am a professor of biology here at NYU New York, and I also run a laboratory at NYU Abu Dhabi. And I also serve as the academic director here at 19 Washington Square North. So over the length of the academic year, 19 Washington Square North is home to many different wonderful programs, lectures, film screenings, workshops, and conferences. And it also serves as a place where community, the NYU Abu Dhabi community, the students, the faculty, the New York community, get together to learn and to know more about different parts of the world, including, of course, Abu Dhabi and the Gulf region. A key partner of ours here is the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute in Abu Dhabi in New York, which organizes many of the activities here at 19 Washington Square North. I want to acknowledge the work of Sharon Hocken-Bergman, the Director of Academic and Research Programs of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute over there at the corner, who with her staff puts many of these activities together. Thank you, Sharon. So today we're very, very pleased to see all of you for this film screening of Nine Parts of Desire, a wonderful film that has been shown around the world and also on PBS these past few months. After the screening, which will run just under an hour, we will have a conversation with the playwright, actor Heather Raffo, and the film producer Nilo Safinia, who's here with us today. This conversation, thank you, give it up for them. So this conversation will be led by Tisch Professor of Drama, Catherine Corey, after the screening. So before we go with the conversation, let's start and screen the film. Thank you. So I want to first of all thank Heather and Nilo for bringing us this wonderful work here. It's really moving and it's a wonderful, wonderful piece. What I neglected to say, by the way, was that the film was an adaptation from Heather's one-woman play that she performed, I don't even remember when, but way back when. But we'll go into that a little more in the short conversation that we're going to have. And I want to introduce the panel that's going to do that. First, the conversation will be led by Catherine Corey, the professor of drama at Tisch and an affiliate faculty at NYU Abu Dhabi, so she can come up. Catherine has taught and collaborated with artists in Austria, Belarus, Chile, Cuba, Egypt, and Lebanon. As an actor, she worked regionally and off-Broadway with directors such as Anne Bogart and Andre Gregory. She was the director of the LARC Middle East US Playwright Exchange and has co-produced various works with the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. Catherine is currently a producing affiliate with the Noor Theater and serves on the advisory boards of the Georgetown Laboratory for Global Performance and Politics Think Tank, Global Thread Productions in San Francisco, and the Artistic Advisory Council of Playwrights Horizon. Thank you. We also have with us Nilo Safinia, an Iranian-American producer working in film and theater and who produced Nine Parts of Desire. Nilo's film career began with Levantine Entertainment as an associate producer from America in 2009, where she served as a vice president of TV and film development and production for 3 years. Her last feature, Julia Blue, in 2018, was shot entirely in Ukraine during wartime and was a Gotham Award winner. Her latest film was a short horror comedy, Snatch, starring Tatiana Maslany, made for Hulu and produced by 20th Century. She's also the founding president of the board of directors for the Obie Award-winning Noor Theater in New York City, dedicated to developing and producing the work of artists of Middle Eastern descent. Thank you. And finally, we have the amazing Heather Raffo. Heather is a singular and outstanding voice in the American theater whose work has been championed by The New Yorker as, quote, an example of how art can remake the world, unquote. Having helped forge a new genre of Arab American theater, she spent her career writing and embodying stories of Iraq. From the lives and dreams of Iraqi women in her seminal work, Nine Parts of Desire, first the play and now the film, to the suicidal ideation of an Iraq war veteran in the opera Fallujah, which was shown in PBS in 2012. To the restless longings of an Iraqi refugee architect in Noura in 2018. A recent Creative Capital, NPN, and APAP grantee, Heather is building an ambitious new theatrical platform following migration and the global economy, which aims to be the first ever evolving multi-locational theater platform. Thank you very much.
Is that on? Oh, it is. Great. So here we are. And well, what do you want to talk about? I'm just kidding. Heather, that's the third time I've watched the movie. And what's that? The third time, absolutely. And I just have to tell you that it's sort of simultaneously inspiring and exciting and deep and very painful. And it's especially right now, if I may. And so seeing the film and hearing the story in this context was a whole new experience for me, if you see what I mean. And I feel as though each time I've watched it, there's been some kind of place that we were in that gave me another perspective on what you had made. And I just want to thank you. We'll see what happens the fourth time I watch it. I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. I think what I would like to do, if it's okay with you, is give the folks here a little insight into how this came together. Because it's kind of a miracle, especially for those of us who had the pleasure of seeing the production, Nine Parts of Desire. And I have to say that watching the film the first time, I was struck by the fact that it felt as though this is what it was always supposed to be. Do you know what I mean? That the voices and the women and the haunting just really came through for me in a whole new way. How did it get started? How did you start to conceive doing it for film? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can speak to our COVID times and theaters reaching out, trying to make virtual theater. And the opportunity came to film what the producers at People's Light and Detroit Public Theater had imagined was going to be a film of a play, a one-woman show. Because it was COVID time, so it was even better. One actress on a stage, let's film it. And that was considered and taken in, but eventually it was not really what the dream was. The dream was a film, but then what? Right? And I think that what continued to eat away at me was my dad had just passed away in March 19th of 2020. So it was right at the beginning of COVID, and March 19th is the anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. So in 2020, that was what anniversary? The 17th, thanks. Good math, right? So that's what I was carrying. But more so than that, I was carrying that when I had written the play, almost all my Iraqi relatives were in Iraq, and I was worried about their lives. And here we were all these decades later, and they were all living in diaspora, having fled. So my sense of homeland and attachment had been deeply discombobulated. And the other big thing I was carrying was the many costs of that war and how they were reverberating through American society. But further to all of that, I'm a Michigan girl. So I was carrying and embodying a swing state through the pandemic, through 2020. And it was and is my belief that we're on the precipice. And that everything we might be thinking of when we saw this play originally, or when you would sit with those Iraqi women and we think this is this country in the Middle East, it was absolutely this country here. The fabric of a society that had been for each other was suddenly not for each other and didn't even know how to continue to talk to each other. So the fault line to me was Michigan. the fault line was a swing state. And I wanted to hear those women in context of this nation. And then I think there's just the reality of film is I look like I look and I'm an American person. And we talked about it. It's like, well, yeah, if you do a film, you want 9 Iraqi actresses on location in the Middle East. It's just what you want. It's what you deserve. It's what you need. That's the film. And this thing is that wasn't the budget. Like this was this own unique little thing. And it's also not the play. The play is you meet these monologues and these women and you feel like you're maybe in Iraq and it's magical realism in the film. And this feels like Anilu was absolutely essentially like inside my skull. She kept excavating what it felt like to be me, Heather, kind of the actress walking around with these women for 20 years, right? It's like, I'm lonely in my grief. I couldn't bury my dad. We couldn't gather publicly. Who's with you? We're talking to ourselves during COVID, right? We were all going completely isolated, crazy. And characters like this, these women, these ancestors, were literally haunting. You know, they're beside me. And that's what happens to, I think, many of us when we lose someone. People come. Spirits come, like we're connected. And Nilu was my creative partner in adapting that to saying, okay, I read this play, I'm holding this play, now what? Right? And they started to haunt the space. The other big thing was we had one location, and that was the oldest Iraqi church in North America that was on the banks of the Flint River. And if anybody'd seen the play, they know that the Tigris is in the middle of the stage and everything goes in and out of that water. And being a Michigan girl, you know, Michigan water is the future of this nation. And what happened in Flint is also the future of this nation. And the, you know, Flint and Michigan is an interesting center with what has happened via the car industry. What has blossomed and then bottomed out because of our need for oil is essential to Flint and Detroit, and what has happened and bottomed out in the Middle East because of our need for oil is, in my opinion, the same thing. So when we walk around that neighborhood in Flint, literally those houses are on either side of the church. It's exactly, we didn't make any, I mean, that's the neighborhood. So it felt like America.
So the conversations about moving 9 parts to film started with you and Nilu? No, talk to me. Where did this start?
Zach.
People's Light in Theater in Pennsylvania.
The artistic director of People's Light Theater saying, hey, it's COVID times. Would you be interested in filming the play? And then many, 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 many conversations.
After he wanted
later.
It, we finished the film.
Yeah, exactly.
After we came out of isolation, the film was finished. So not quite when Zach wanted it, but yeah, it started with Zach, and then Detroit Public Theater also got involved, and they became the co-partner. And we started some partnership conversations with PBS as well in Detroit, and there were a couple of iterations that we went through. And ultimately, once we decided that this was the version of the film we wanted to make, and we were all set on that, then it took some time to get us to a place where we could do that and do it in the right way. And that's what brought us here ultimately, but it took a little bit longer than we'd originally planned.
And I remember having conversations with you, Heather, about who would direct the film, and Mike seemed like just sort of a natural way to go. Can you talk a little bit about how you came together with Mike and how the three of you worked together a little bit?
I wouldn't say working with Mike, but in conversation with Mike via Anur commission that happened during COVID.
That I facilitated.
That you facilitated, and you facilitated that meeting. And he and I had an uncanny relationship. And when it became really clear to me that Michigan was at the heart of what I was hoping would happen with this. Mike Masalam is a film director born and raised in Michigan. And for the, I know most of you know this, but Michigan has the largest Arab American community anywhere in the world outside of the Middle East. And Mike was raised there. So while neither of us were raised in Flint, we just kept circling the thing we wanted to think about and say about Michigan. And Mike's very used to the constraints of theater as well. So it was kind of handy that it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't expecting the big budgets mm-hmm. to come in. Like we knew what the undertaking was.
Right. Mike's a wonderful artist and a great director. And he actually created a film that some of you may want to check into also called Breaking Fast. Very special movie, very special. Okay, so.
And he brings so much humor to the room.
Always.
And that was so, the levity was so precious in this process to have him walk in on rehearsal days singing musical theater at the top of his lungs as we're, right? Doing all this.
Yeah. Mike's stories later on. No, we adore him. He's in California, otherwise he would be with us right now. Did you go to People's Light as part of the developmental process? Were you working on the campus there, or how did it work?
Were we in person in Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. So go ahead.
All of the film development work was essentially done remotely.
Got it.
Heather and I worked on the script remotely for a while. Mm-hmm. And then we finally, we also went to Michigan a couple of times to scout. Mm-hmm. We did that together one time, the three of us, and then another time Heather and I went back, just the two of us. And then right before we went into production, I think a month before we went into production, Heather and I went out to LA and spent a few days just with Mike, the three of mm-hmm. us. To do to rehearse, since Heather was all the actors, so we didn't need anybody else there. So
right.
That was useful. But yeah,
we needed did other that. People there, but we just didn't have.
We didn't have anybody else. But yeah, we did. That was essentially it. Most of it was all done virtually.
Right, right. Another thing I wanted to touch on, Heather, it was part of the conversation we had last weekend when we were did the panel for the. MENA Theater Makers convening, and just talking about the immigrant communities that we three and many people here have been part of, and what was it like to actually be there? Do you know what I mean? To be in that area where you had grown up, and what is the community like there now?
Well, the community in Michigan changes regularly mm-hmm. with each new wave of immigration. It also changes zeitgeist quite regularly with each new tragedy.
Yeah.
Right? It was not the same community pre 9/11 than it was post 9/11. It's not the same community now. The largest Iraqi Christian, which is what I am, Chaldean community anywhere in the world is now in Michigan, post ISIS overtaking Mosul in Iraq. So like it, mm-hmm. it's just, and you know, it changes. What the community changes. Michigan as a community itself is really compelling to me because it's got one of the largest Black cities in Detroit of anywhere in the nation. Mm-hmm. It's just so diverse. It's Black and white. It's liberal. It's conservative. It's Muslim. It's Christian. Like it's a true kind of diversity that when you can do theater, I'd say more than film, you're in a hot conversation that feels like it's the most essential conversation of the country.
Yeah. Absolutely. Before I open it up and see if anybody would like to ask you, either of you or both of you, a couple of questions, I'm wondering what the reception to the film has been. What have you experienced in terms of people talking to you about their experience of watching the film and how they're relating to it?
I would say that one thing that was really moving to me personally is on the actual 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, which was in March this year, we got to do a live screening in Detroit for a large number of Iraqi Americans, but again, a very diverse audience. And the Iraqi community was really experiencing a lot of intense memories from the war, but also a lot of unnamed grief, right? And I think that's really what I'm sitting with when I watched it today again, is the kind of grief that comes out of your root system and doesn't get resolved, and war just violence compounds and compounds and compounds those kinds of griefs. And I mean, I had 100 family members in Iraq. Like, we were literally from a place, not Iraq, a place in Iraq, four thousands of generations, like as far back as anyone knows. And now we're not from there anymore. These things are like, how do you even process them? Right? And how do you hold that alongside the generational trauma that is so apparent to everyone in the Middle East right now? Right? Like it is so painful that it feels like the essentialness of art actually to say we need to grieve and we need to mourn and we need to be in community together and we need nuanced conversations and we need complex humans and characters and situations is like imperative for the precipices that we are on as humanity. I mean, it's not like great art in times of war. Like, I mean, the play was up and running through the entire war and occupation for over a decade. Right? Like military men and women came and needed to talk, and military families would come, and like people that served and like killed Uday would come up to me in Tennessee and be like, I was in the platoon, I did this, I need to talk. Like the amount of needing to talk that is part of mourning and grief is so essential. So I'd say that the general response to the play when it was up and to having aired it, you know, is just that like it's burying that stuff isn't getting us anywhere.
Right. And you and I have been talking very recently about coming together with people in the community, that just even being in the same room has a tremendously healing effect on all of us. Even
having
when we
difficult
were,
conversation.
And we were in a virtual panel last weekend, and even that was helpful, just to hear from everybody and just to know what everyone has been dealing with, especially the last month. I would really like to open this up and see if anybody has any questions or, yeah.
Thank you very much for the film. My name is Hussein Simko. I'm from Iraq, Kurdistan, Iraq. And I just wanted to ask, actually, when was the last time you went back to Iraq and paid a visit? That's all.
Yeah, the last time was 2013. Okay.
How did it feel for you then?
It felt important. Each time I go, it feels like touching my soul. Right. But it also felt so different in 2013 than it had the time I was there before, which was in 1993. And my freedom of movement was very different in 2013. So I felt like I was doing a deep dive in a small way. I was in Kurdistan, but that I couldn't, you know, I didn't get to go to Baghdad. I didn't get to go to Mosul on that trip. So it was, honestly, it felt like saying goodbye, not to the country, but to my family's place in as part of the fabric of the nation.
Yeah. What else? Yes, please.
From the title before I decided to come, I thought the movie is going to be about, because it said the lives and loves of Iraqi women. So I thought the movie is in Iraq. And now apparently are American, Iraqi American in Michigan, Detroit. So for me, this doesn't really give me, you know, the real, real things about Iraq.
Anything else?
Confusing advertising.
We watch out for that. Yeah.
Do we want to talk about the women, the ancestors, the other women, and where their stories came from?
That's a great idea.
Yeah, the original play is built around the nine women that that in the play take place in different monologues. The Bedouin and the artist and the girl and the exile. And those came out of years worth of interviews with Iraqi women. And I think that in that's how I have been carrying and holding their lives and loves. I can imagine though, when you're only seeing Michigan, because film is so realistic and way less metaphoric than when we're in the live in theater and can give you a set and kind of make believe we're in different places. I can imagine how the push and pull of reality of what's happening could be confusing. And there are elements of this that are totally confusing. You know, and you can only get to where you can get. Like, there's sometimes I'm like, we should have just shot monologues and just spent it, you know, like, I don't know. Like,
but
sometimes
it is magical realism, right? The film, that is part of the structure of the film. It's up to you a lot of times to also decide if how much of these women are meant to be real, if they are figments of the American's imagination, if they are parts of her, if they are her ancestors, what they are. Somehow the grief within her is calling them to her, right? To help her through the mourning. But it's up to you to decide how much of them is real and how much of that is not real.
Since we're talking about that, I'm just wondering from your perspective, since we have you and we so seldom do, just to say, I'm curious as to what were the particular challenges. I'm sure there were many producing a film, but what were the particular joys around this for you?
That's a great question. That's not where I thought that question was going. I was really ready for the first part. I think one of the things I would say is that we intentionally crewed up this film to have a lot of women on the set. In the film industry, that's not really an easy thing to do. You have to do it with a lot of intention. It takes a lot of effort to have your lighting and your grip department be entirely women, to have your camera department be entirely women is a hard thing to do. And we did it on purpose because this is a film about women and women's experiences. And we wanted to have as many women in the room as we could to be a part of that storytelling. And it's very rare to have everybody in your crew feel truly invested in the storytelling. Normally your grip, again, is not listening to the story. That's not their job. They're there to do their job and that's it. But every single person who was on our crew really cared about the story and they were so invested. And I would watch them during scenes and watch them watch Heather's performance at times, and they would cry, they would get teary-eyed, they would get emotional. They would come to us afterwards and express their emotions and their thoughts about it. And that was really, really amazing and truly rewarding. And I think had a lot to do with a lot of women being on our set too.
Wonderful. Yes, please.
Two more technical questions. One is, who is the body double and did you get to rehearse with them? And the second is, and this is more for the director, but maybe you know, like, what was the intention behind the color timing that made everything have like a very strong teal wash? So all your blacks were going teal and all of that at the, especially when the American was walking around. I was kind of curious if there was a, like a, you know, a coding to that color timing.
So our body double, and there was only one, as you noticed. Ideally, there would have been many, but again, budgetary constraints, we only had the one. She was very intentionally chosen, one of Heather's very, very best friends, luckily also blonde and of similar build, similar enough that it worked out, but really important that she was somebody that Heather was very connected to. And they both, like, they have such a soul and heart connection that there was really not any rehearsal time that they were afforded, nor was it really needed, luckily, because of how connected they are. There was another thing about having Amy on set was that we knew that she would really protect Heather and take care of her in a lot of ways. But again, with limited resources, we wanted somebody there that would also be holding Heather throughout the process. So having Amy was, she ended up being the person who held me throughout the entire process as well. She truly was a godsend for all of us. For the color, great question. One thing I will say is that, unfortunately, this was not the most accurate version of the color that you were watching here. There were a lot of mirages happening on this projection that are not intentional. And the teal was coming out in a way that was a lot stronger than the way that the film was colored. But there definitely was a progression in the color story that went from beginning to end. And it's timed sort of with this, the world of the women and the world of the ancestors and the way that the American is allowing them to come into her reality, or the way that they are entering into her reality. So the world starts in a place that is less realistic. And as we start to go through the different parts, it becomes more and more realistic.
Thank you for asking about the body double. I meant to do that. I really did. Yes.
And seeing this, it's really beautiful. And so in some ways it feels so similar and some ways so different. I'm curious, as someone embodying this role, these nine roles, in stage form, what was your process preparing for like these roles differently? And I know, having sat with them for such a long time now, how moving between them in a production process and a film process, how that was different in theater versus film.
It's the film was so much harder, even though doing a solo show is the hardest thing I ever did. But in the play, they once you start with one and then move to the next, you're building a momentum that the actor is in control of for the 90 minutes. So I was absolutely in control of who thought who was funny and what was the audience reaction and which character was pushing energy this way so the other one could pick it up and run with it. And after 90 minutes, I was exhausted. And that was one of the points, is like, war feels like this. And right. And with this one, and also in the stage play, I was talking to the audience. So I had my scene partner. And this was really This was so terrifying, because even with Amy to talk to sometimes, it wasn't all the time. So it was very discombobulating to not know who I, you know, with actors, that's what we're trained for. We're going for one thing from a person, right? So it was that with so little rehearsal was what we did was nearly impossible, right? Like, it was so ambitious an idea for really truly being nearly impossible to do. Like, we shot it in 6 days, and that all that material, it's like basically go do a monologue twice. Moving on, like that. That's so. It's an experiment. Like, it's an experiment of this idea system, and then you have to trust. Well, okay, the women have been living in there for 20 years, but for sure the acting is entirely different, because they're to this woman's point, is they're all shades. They're just like a little shadow of me, and they're meant to be. They're not meant to be. Those 9 actual women from, they're meant to be, oh my, she must be talking to herself. She literally must be going crazy. She must have Alzheimer's like her father, right? What is going on that this has happened, right? So it was all very.
Heather was brilliant to answer your question from another perspective. What she did in those 6 days and what she was asked to do and holding all of those different characters, we tried our best to make it easier on her in the way that the days were scheduled. So she wasn't doing all characters in one day, but she had to go back and forth a lot, and keeping all of that together. And like half of the time she knew better what was going on than anybody else did. And it was really incredibly impressive. We also had an excellent script supervisor on set, excellent, who without her, I think we would have made 5,000 mistakes that I don't think we would have been able to correct in post. But she was really, really meticulous and kept us on top of everything, especially with the body double, especially with all that movement, making sure that all of our shots were matching. And yes, we did shoot it in 6 days, which was insanity. We're all too old for that kind of production schedule. But we did it, and here it is now.
Do we have one last question? Yes.
Hi, Heather. So my question is, so in the Chaldean community, and probably in most Middle Eastern communities, there's kind of these like topics that go undiscussed, kind of under the surface. They're taboo almost in a way, like womanhood, war, you know, trauma, things of that sort. And so in putting something like that, one of those topics, into a tangible form, into film or theater or a piece of art, did you face any type of pushback or any type of resistance from the community in the work? And how did you find the courage to kind of continue telling the story and doing this important work?
Yeah, I would say doing the play during the Iraq War and for that decade after, there wasn't much pushback. Iraqis at that time, I mean, this is before a genre of Middle Eastern American theater existed in this nation, right? Iraqis were like, oh my God, you're saying that on stage? Like, this is, how do you do, is that okay? Are you okay, right? Like, and then they needed to feed me, right? So that sense of like, and they couldn't believe American audiences were watching it and crying or laughing or whatever. Like, they couldn't believe they were feeling understood. So there really wasn't much, pushback then. That doesn't mean it wasn't dangerous. Like, where it was dangerous and where the pushback was from, America not wanting an Iraqi story on stage. Like, that, there was a lot of pushback about that, right? But I would say that I would say the only pushback we got in the film land was that we were supposed to actually shoot in the oldest Iraqi church and were offered it, you know, people that were working there who love my work and wanted to give us this sacred space, right? And the bishop found out and was like, oh, hell no, there will not be a movie.
10 days before the shoot.
Right. So then we had, then it was all off and we had to go find an interior that, and that in retrospect, I'm so thankful for that. Like, of course I wouldn't have been thankful if we never, ever got to shoot it and that would have been that. But like the idea that the Presbyterians don't mind so much. If you're going to come in and
we took be over
Muslim
the whole
and be
church.
Christian
yeah,
and
exactly.
talk about the love light, talk about anything and do something like this, like, right. But the, so I'm thankful in the end that we didn't shoot in the exact Iraqi church, oldest Iraqi church. I think it's, we had
a lot more freedom and freedom. Yeah. And space at the end of the day, it actually was like, it would have been a nightmare to film in that church at the end of the day. It worked out
well
the way it was supposed to.
We have, I hate to do this, but we do need to wrap up. And I would like to end with a memory, which actually is of something that happened right here in this room 10 years ago when we had a convening of Middle Eastern women in theater. And you were up here, right, pretty much where you are now, presenting an excerpt from Nine Parts of Desire. And ended with, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. And that beautiful Iraqi playwright stood up and was like, I love you, I love you, I love you, back to you, okay? And it was a very full and beautiful moment for all of us. So I just wanted to.
And that's Catherine, who brings us all together.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.